Like, I don't know. I don't know if it's that interesting.
But, like, I wanted to make a comment, send out an email. And
that's true. And that
we had a lot of discussion, which kind of surprised me.
We had a decent discussion going on last week.
So now, I need to be more specific when I send out stuff, though. It's like, obviously, I don't think.
I didn't notice that. Did anyone?
Oh, well, Christian is, like, saying something. What did he say? Something about, well, clearly there has to be something beyond just failure. It's like, well, I assumed we all do that. But have to learn from failure and stuff like that. But.
And that's, and it really, I think these issues are really all about balance. I don't think that there's any, sometimes in articles they want to make it be all or nothing, but I think that there, we understand that there is, you know, there's balance in these issues. It's not like everything is group creativity or everything's individual creativity or something.
I call it the Glenn Beck effect, because he always, like, pushes things so far to the extreme that I really hope he, I'm sure he doesn't believe half of what he's saying, but he's just trying to, like, jar people enough to start thinking
right
in that direction.
Ezekiel, yes.
Yeah.
Converted, right?
To So this week we were doing group flow. This is actually, I think,
fun chapter.
It's a fun chapter.
Yeah, that was.
It's one of my favorites because it's so clear.
Mm.
And now it's interesting because it's not written necessarily academically.
No.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But he's very academic.
Yeah.
He's actually the editor of the Handbook of Learning Sciences.
Oh, really?
I mean, this guy is brilliant. He's a brilliant academic, and he writes lots of research articles. He's got like 100 research articles.
So he knows how to switch.
But then he can talk.
Yeah.
And so this is based on a lot of research, but he writes it in a way that he's trying to make it easier to understand and memorable.
Yeah, I was really surprised, because most people who write well academically can't write well, you know, just to the common man. And it was very well written, I thought.
So. Yeah. It's actually an interesting audiobook, which if any of you want to listen to the audiobook, I could probably loan it to you.
Mm-hmm.
But I have it, the audiobook too. So, but anyway, I'll just. What do you guys think? What were some impressions you had, or thoughts, or things that you thought were interesting from this week? From this week's reading.
I don't know if necessary. I like the name Flow. I do understand, but I think what he's saying is. I mean, not true or anything, but I do know that it does happen, and then when it happens, it's pretty cool experience, and I think it's kind of difficult thing to study as well, you know, but I
it is a very difficult thing to study.
Yeah, it's just so random, so you know, there was a, like a, you know, familiarities and what is it like a 10 elements that happens, but even you have all that, it does not guarantee that it does happen.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's really difficult things to study, yet a fascinating thing.
Well, here's what I was thinking. It's like, I mean, I think we've all hopefully been in those groups before, and we've seen what it's like, and he's outlined, you know, what you need in order to make it happen, but how do you create those teams? Is it the luck of the draw? Do you focus on certain aspects that he's outlined to be able to create that kind of a flow in a group? Or how does the group get to that point, I guess is what I'm saying.
I think you've raised several things. I'll talk about a couple of them here. One, I think flow is actually a legitimate learning theory that people study. But I think everyone who does study it has the same feeling like, I wish we could call it something else, because it sounds so like, you tell people, you're like, oh, I'm studying flow, and they're like, what, did you just make that up, you know, kind of a thing. But it is a legitimate theory. He talks about it. It comes from a guy named Csikszentmihalyi. That is actually the right way to pronounce it.
Csikszentmihalyi.
I'm not sure, actually.
And Hakkarainen.
And Hakkarainen is, someone different. But Csikszentmihalyi came out with a book in 1991 called Flow. And when he did it, it was about an individual achieving a flow state.
Right.
And he laid out, and he studied it for years with people working with him. And they came up with, you know, different characteristics of what makes it more likely. I think it's one of those things, it's like growing a garden. You can't force it to happen. But you can do things to make it kind of more likely that it could happen. And they would... And they defined it so that you could understand when it was and when it wasn't happening and that kind of a thing. And Csikszentmihalyi was, I guess, Keith Sawyer's advisor. And that's where he learned about it. And then he started getting into this group creativity and started thinking, well, wait a minute. Can I take this individual theory and put it into group? Csikszentmihalyi uses flow to talk about, they use it to talk about creativity, because he talks about that you're most creative when you're in flow.
Yeah. grumpy.
They also used it to talk about happiness. It actually stemmed from happiness research. He was studying people who are happy. Because when you're in flow, you are extremely happy. I mean, those are the kind of people that they love the work that they're doing,
right.
or the project they're on. Or, you know, when you're most happy outside of work even, you know, playing basketball or in a conversation with someone, you're engaging in that kind of a flow. He calls it optimal experience. When you're kind of just really, you know, optimally experiencing life and the maximum of your ability and that kind of a thing. So he talks about it here. This, you know, Csikszentmihalyi says, flow occurs from pushing yourself to complete something that's intrinsically interesting, but it's just beyond your expertise. It's not so far that it depresses you, but just barely. And he has this little chart here that is, I think, kind of interesting. It can't be so difficult that then you get anxious about it. The challenge. It can't be so high up the challenge scale that you then become nervous and anxious about it. That doesn't work. And it can't be so, you know, far down the skills scale that you're either bored because it's too hard or bored because it's too easy. It has to be, there's kind of this little interesting channel that he talks about that's in between all of that. That's peak performance, where the challenge is challenging but not too much. You have the skills, but you still have to learn more skills. And that kind of is when people get really excited. And that's when learning's fun, to be honest with you. That's when you say, I love that. That was fun. And I learned a lot.
It's interesting that he used Bill Russell's comment.
From basketball?
From the basketball.
Yeah.
Because I do know that, like, you know, Michael Jordan talk about flow. And a lot of athletes experience where there's a moment sometimes, like, you know what? Or like Vince Carter talk about it. He's like, you know, how do you do all the cool dunks and like stuff? He's like, you know, you're just in the mood.
Yeah.
You get the ball. Your body just does it. I don't know. It just does it. It's just I'm in the mood. And then Jordan talk about how, you know, I didn't make 40 points or 35 points every game. I'm in the mood. I throw the ball. It goes in.
And everything goes in. Yeah. They talk about the rim being
as
big as an ocean. Everything you throw up is going in.
But same time, though, I think Bill Ross is a good example because he had 11 championships. He had like 8 consecutive championships, which is very difficult to do. But, you know, the anxiety level, like a peak performance, I mean, no one ever got championship 8 times but in his biography, he talked about how he was obsessed with winning. Like, the teammate thought that he's just crazy about, like, this guy is just obsessed. And several times he threw up before the game.
Yeah.
Not even championship game. He just throw up because of the pressure he puts on himself.
Obsessed is a good word for it. People who are in flow are usually obsessed with what they're doing. And he talks about this in this chapter, that it can be a problem because they will ignore other things.
Exactly.
Because they're so focused on something. They're just in that flow and they're just obsessed with it. And that's how you can often figure out if people have experienced it or not.
Yeah.
Because if you say, have you been in flow? They're like, I don't know what you're talking about. But if you can say, describe for me what it was like working on this project, you can pick out some of the things that they say. For example, this is from my dissertation. And like for Robin, for example, she would say, I was kind of working in that zone yesterday. She talked about it. I was just working and working. I could see myself get sucked into playing this for a while.
Mm-hmm.
So she would talk about it. I'd get sucked in. I'd be doing it for hours and hours. And then I'd look up and go, shoot, I missed dinner.
Yeah.
You know, kind of a thing. She would say that. And I'm like, that was flow. You know, Boyd actually, now they had learned about flow, so he actually knew what it was. And so he said, yeah, you get lost in the flow. Lori said, yeah, you look up at the clock and you're like, oh, I missed lunch. You know, Jamie would say, I'd spend hours on it and not even realize. So I was just obsessed with this thing I was working on.
I wonder what chemical is going in
your brain to make that happen?
It's not adrenaline.
Adrenaline, yeah.
Because that's just a feeling of excitement.
Right.
But it's just like you focus on one thing.
It's like dopamine.
You don't care about anything else. You just like,
all like a dopamine, because you get you can almost get like high and addicted to it.
Exactly.
It's
just like,
you know, it's very exciting.
You don't need to sleep, you can just keep going, going.
I mean, how many of us have ever had that experience, right?
Oh yeah.
Where you're working on something. For me, it's often when I'm working on like a website design. Like I'm trying to redesign my website.
Yeah.
And I'll spend all night long. I'm like, I'm almost there, and I'm just obsessed with it. And it's just barely beyond my expertise.
Yeah.
I'm learning new things. I'm like, okay, I've got to figure out how to do this. And I'll spend hours working on it. You know?
Yeah.
So anyway, So interesting. But so Dan brought up the question. So that's kind of what flow is. Dan brought up the question, well, how do we do it? Which is the question of the day.
Did you use this presentation somewhere? Or?
This was my presentation at AECT.
Can we have this?
Yeah. Yeah, sure. It's on my website, but I can show you where
it is.
You
just made it for this. That's awesome.
I know. I love you guys so much. I put together this huge presentation just for you. what was I just talking about? Oh, group flow.
Yeah. How do you do it?
So Keith Sawyer, but I mean, he kind of talked about these 10 things of group flow, where he talked about, you know, and you look at these things and you say, from a management perspective or a teacher perspective, if we're working in schools or something, you could engineer some of these. And make it more likely. I mean, shared goals, that's a little hard, but, you know, like they do in the boot camp where they're trying to say, you know, you should come up with a project that you're all agreeing on.
Yeah.
You know? Deep listening is hard, but, you know, creating an opportunity where there's less distraction and where they're, you know, forced. One thing that they did, for example, out in Georgia to force deep listening a little bit better is they were having people, they basically were pretty open and saying, you can work whenever you want, you can work at home. And they realized that there wasn't as much of that group creativity going on. Mm-hmm. So they said, all right, well, there's a certain amount of days where you have to be together. You don't have to necessarily, you can work on whatever you want. So everyone's in their own computer working on something, but just because they're together, it was easy to then, conversations would start.
Studio.
Yeah, and they would start to talk and why don't you look at nowadays. This? Peter's trying to do that too. You know, there's something about having people together listening to each other and talking to each other.
So that's my big thing about distance learning is that I think you're losing that when you're doing distance learning. Even if you have some type of, you know, online communication, it's not the same as that in-person communication. I think there's something lost there.
And that is the interesting thing because business models are moving very much towards telecommuting.
Yeah, exactly.
So, and I think, and John Seely Brown, did you ever go listen to that?
No.
That's actually the assignment for next week. We're going to, instead of reading an article, we're just going to watch John Seely Brown.
Cool.
He talked about in there, he said, he wrote a book in the 90s where he basically said face-to-face interaction will never replace virtual interaction. But then in his presentation, he's a famous, huge psychology learning researcher. He came just a couple weeks ago and talked to us. But he said in his presentation, he said, I've actually changed my mind. He's like, if you've read my book, he's like, I've changed my mind. I think virtual interaction can approximate the richness of face-to-face interaction. And he gave examples of gaming environments where multiplayer games where the players are all virtual, but they log in together and they have their chat windows open and they're listening to each other and watching what each other is doing as they're working. And they work as a team. I mean, they are in the zone. Do you know what I mean? And they get upset into that. And so you think, well, can we somehow create that kind of rich social interaction
in
things outside of games? No, he's talking about like World War. Stuff.
Well, I know, but I'm saying, like, how do you take playing a game into a business model?
And maybe try to somehow create that. Or maybe you log into your dashboard and all of a sudden all your contacts show up.
But I think that's...
And you can work with each other and stuff, you know.
I think that's what adult might be. But I don't know if I want my little boy or whatever to just completely...
Yeah.
Virtually attending schools.
No. I'm not going to go that far either.
But I could see.
But my thing is, we can't get away from distance learning.
Can
we make distance learning as rich so that this deep listening can happen in distance learning? We don't want it to be absent.
You know? I think people have to get used to it. You know how sometimes people don't like Skype because they're not used to talking face-to-face, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But they're used to phone.
Yeah.
So they can have deep conversations through the phone.
That's right.
But once they start to Skype, they can't. They just can't talk deep stuff.
That's right.
So as soon as people, I don't know, maybe new generation, like, they're so used to it, they're like, well, that's what we do.
So you helped me make my point. talking on the phone for me, yeah, I can get into a deep conversation, but there's so much lacking that I can't portray just audio-wise. Then Skype gives me another level, but it's still not the same as being in person. And so I definitely think, obviously, we don't want to get rid of distance education. There's a place for it.
Yeah, exactly.
And I think that we should definitely do something to provide to allow that, you know, that deep listening to occur in that. I mean, it's just my hometown, for instance. It's a great alternative for them because it's 2 hours away from anything.
Yeah.
However,
I have a problem with people who are trying to replace the classroom with that. That's why I'm a fan of blended learning.
Yeah.
Because there's definitely advantages. I think there's also advantages to...
And I think blended is a good idea. And if you look at this for as a creativity kind of a thing, maybe that's part of what we need to do as researchers is figure out, okay, how do we blend this?
Mm.
And what kinds of situations do we bring the group together face-to-face? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
And what kinds of things can we moderate online?
That
kind of a thing. And that's a whole wide open area for us to study. Is how could we create blended creative experiences?
That's interesting.
But, looking at some of these other things that he talks about, group flow, complete concentration. So removing distractions and part of that could be as well removing too much pressure. He talks about in the chapter that pressure, you want some pressure, but not too much.
But yeah, at the same time.
Yeah, and I found in my dissertation that was one of the biggest hindrances to their creativity was, I got to get this done by the end of the semester.
I thought you meant that was your motivation, that you felt the pressure.
I definitely felt pressure for my dissertation as well. And maybe that did limit my creativity, it probably did. But yeah, these people would talk about, they'd be like, I've got these great ideas for what I want to do with my project. I just can't do it anymore. I've got to get something done, and I'm stressed out because I don't have anything ready for next week. You know what I mean? And so that's hard,
See, I was just thinking about that because I've been trying to get this video done. I had to do a video for Charles's class, and it was due last night at midnight.
Okay. With who? Oh, it was due?
And so I've been working on it. I had it all kind of, together, and it was looking pretty good. But there's all these things I still wanted to, do, and I wanted to do a little bit more. But finally, I just had to push it out. And I was thinking about it, actually, just before this meeting started. I was like, I don't think it's that bad. And, I think the deadline helped me to move forward. So I think, like you said, pressure makes you move forward, but too much pressure just makes you collapse.
And there used to be some, and that's another balancing act kind of a thing. When you look about in business, you want to have people be working, but then you don't want to be saying, if you don't get this done by this time, your job's over or something like that, you're up. Because then people just freeze up and they can't concentrate.
I guess that's why that chart.
That's right. Yeah, and that, you don't want too much of that anxiety.
Yeah.
Flow is really about balancing. And maybe a skillful teacher, if they understood flow, could be kind of moving the pieces.
Mm-hmm.
And then if they see it going too far one direction, pulling it back another direction so that they get into that channel.
Mm-hmm.
And that, they get balanced in that channel. You know what I mean? We find in boot camp, for example, maybe things are not challenging enough, I wonder, sometimes.
Yeah.
And if it needs to be a little bit more challenging, they might have a little bit more flow.
Yeah, I guess that's concept-wise, it's sort of easy to understand. Okay, so it's not challenging for them.
They
come up with some flow.
And they sit around, look at each other, and go.
Well, the other hand, animation might be more challenging.
Yeah.
Because I know my roommate used to work there. Oh, he worked so long and so hard, and it was a challenging task for all of them.
Yeah.
Madani or whatever. So
it's true.
They pushes it, but I don't know if bootcamp is pushing enough to.
And it might be because it's harder with the limitations they have to deal with.
Yeah,
but that's
what
we're trying to study is understand, can we do it in their kind of a confined timeline?
Yeah.
You had a question?
Well, here's a thought.
Yeah.
So we're talking about how flow is a balancing act. Is there some role that someone takes on to help balance that? Is that an individual or is that as a group?
Is there someone within the group who somehow keeps the group in flow or something like that?
What's a idea?
The parent?
The guy with the bell.
Mm, yeah.
What's his name?
Who really wasn't necessarily any more important than anyone else,
right.
But
his
job was to keep everyone in flow, basically,
right.
To bring him back in.
Yeah. To keep the balance, I guess.
Yeah.
Like if one guy's going too far, I understand, you come down, and then the other guy's up.
Let's hear some other people.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so is that something that, do you need that individual who has that balance, or is it something that the group can have as themselves, as the group?
That is an interesting question. And that would be something we could look at, too, as we started looking at the more successful groups that we observe.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe we can say, why? And maybe there is a particular kind of a person in each group. Maybe we'll find that, The equal participation is interesting. They talk about in creativity needing diversity. And we found in boot camp that some of the groups are diverse but don't utilize their diversity. There isn't that group equal participation. It's two or three people that dominate everything. Yeah.
So, as far as equal participation goes, if you have a big group, how are you going to make it so that everybody is given the same amount of, I don't know, like, I can't think right now, but the, like, is at the same skill level so that they have the same schedule that they have to deal with?
I think the groups typically are smaller. They're not like super huge, like 20.
I want to say something like 7.
4, 5, 6, 7, something like that. He talks about basketball teams. He talks about jazz improv groups, which are normally like 3 or 4 people, or well, more like 5 or 6, I guess, that are improv groups, you know, playing their jazz music.
Yeah.
The groups at the boot camp are about 4 or 5. Now, animation department is 20, but they break into smaller teams.
Yeah, they do different, like a, they do like a
background,
and then they do like a structural thing, and they will do the modeling.
People who are in charge of the
lighting,
modeling and stuff like that.
So they do different
groups. That may be something interesting. At what point does the group become too big to engage in flow? Can you have 10 people as a whole group in flow? You know what? I mean, maybe you can to some degree. Have you ever seen those like flash mobs? You know? They're completely synchronized, and they're improvising things together, and they're doing things together. I mean, I don't know. Probably definitely more challenging.
Oh, yeah.
But, you know, can it happen? You talk about mob violence. You know, that's a form of flow, but in a bad way.
True.
Do you know what I mean? Where they're all in this kind of peak.
Same goal, same
they're
mindset.
All in their, you know, kind of a thing. And so, you know, maybe it could. But that's something interesting to look at. Familiarity is interesting. And that kind of goes with the idea that you can't just throw a bunch of strangers together and have them all of a sudden have flow together. You know, the basketball team, you know each other so well, you're like, well, I knew John was going to be there right at that moment, you know. Hey.
Hey.
Do you need the room?
I think we had scheduled it this time.
At 1 o'clock?
Yeah. Actually, I have to go.
And you have to go. Well, we're actually done with this. We'll go to my office and the group meeting part, but thanks for coming, Melia, and that was the article for this week. Interesting stuff. I think it's one that I like rereading over and over again.
I enjoyed that one, actually, quite a bit.
And I think a lot of relevance for us as we start moving into coding, because a lot of the coding categories I derive from his 10 things there.
Yeah, like you'll categories make a lot more sense now.
I'm hoping that was my goal. I was hoping that made a lot more sense, those categories. So...